Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2007 Home Education Conference held at Southern Virginia University.
Okay, all right. Well, welcome to the 2007 annual LDS EHE Home Education Conference here at Southern Virginia University. My name's Ariel Rodriguez, and I'm a professor here at Southern Virginia University. Oh boy, we have exciting fans. That's good. See, I'm here, wherever you are. I'm a professor in the Family and Child Development Program. And my topic today is really, I'm here to talk about conflict in families and maybe help you get a better understanding of that and how to deal with it. Specifically, the title of the talk is there. It's He That Troubleth His Own House, which is, of course, reference to a scripture that says, He that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind. First of all, an overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about anger. I'm going to talk about parental anger. I'm going to talk about the effects of parental anger on children. I'm going to talk a little bit about emotional honesty, which is kind of like my view. I'm going to tell you my famous story about the brownies, which all of my students here at Southern Virginia eventually get to hear sooner or later. I'm going to talk about conflict and marital conflict in particular, and then I'm going to talk about solutions and strategies and principles that involve not only marital conflict, but just parent-child relationships as well. Let's start off with anger. And I want to suggest, in case you don't know, that anger is a problem. Right. For many couples, in fact, one of the biggest challenges they face in their marriage is dealing with anger and dealing with conflict resolution. Right? It's a very common... Now, I'm not saying that's the thing that leads to... I mean, usually we have other kinds of problems in our marriages, right? We have problems talking about finances or problems agreeing on how to raise the children or problems like in our intimacy and sex life. But whatever those problems are, the issue is if we can't resolve differences, then that makes anything worse, right? Unresolved and out of control. Conflict is really bad. Second of all, oops, now I can go backwards. Okay, for many parents, the biggest challenge in parenting is dealing with parental anger, right? And if not parental anger, then it's certainly another thing that everybody sooner or later has to deal with is sibling conflict, right? Sibling conflict is another big challenge of parenting. And so that's why I think this is kind of an important topic to deal with. If you're a home educator, conflict and anger are going to be big issues that you have to deal with, right? So parental anger, just again, this is like brief facts, kind of statistics things. Eventually, I want to spend more of the time talking about solutions. Parental anger undermines parental love and discipline, and this is one of the main reasons why it is a big no-no for you, right? You really, as a parent, don't want to do that, because when you become angry, it undermines all the positive affect in the relationship with your child. All the love you express and all the good stuff starts to sort of get whittled away if you have a lot of uncontrolled anger, really. Uncontrolled. I guess I should say uncontrolled anger. Also, anger is going to undermine your discipline. Okay, first of all, you're not as effective as a disciplinarian when you're angry. But second of all, if you're angry at your child a lot, it sort of undermines their willingness to sort of want to listen to you and respect you and accept what you have to say. Right. So it's a real problem. The number one cause of parental anger is everyday hassles. Right. Everyday hassles. You remember this if you ever had toddlers in your life, right? The whining, the spills. The interruptions. I used to think our kids had like some special radar and they could tell when my wife was on the phone, because she would get on the phone and they would, no matter how interested they were in what they were doing, somehow they would suddenly notice that mom was on the phone and they'd go over and start trying to interrupt her and get her attention. It was just uncanny how they could do that. Anyway, parenting hassles create what researchers call is a negative mood. And specifically what they mean by that is the idea that as a parent, you will begin to overemphasize the negative stuff your kids are doing. Your perceptions literally change. You get into this mode where you're thinking, boy, my kid's clumsy, my kid makes mistakes, my kid's always doing this, my kid's always doing that, it's driving me crazy. You sort of start to overemphasize the negative, right? Parental anger, the negative mood then leads, of course, to anger eventually. It changes your threshold for feeling anger, right? When you're in that mode where you see all the negative that your child does and how much it drives you crazy, it changes your threshold for anger, and suddenly it's easier for you to get angry, right? And once you get angry, it leads to bad parenting, right? Typically, we're not at our top form in discipline or in anything we do if we get angry enough, right? And I guess, again, I need to emphasize that really this is research about uncontrolled anger, the kind of things that parents do when they're not really in control.
Can you just give an example? What is uncontrolled anger?
Like rolling stuff? No. Like saying things that you probably shouldn't say to your child. Like, yeah, I'm sick and tired of you always doing this. Why are you so clumsy? I've told you before. You know, even things like that would be, if they're said in an angry way, that's what I'm talking about by out of control anger. In control anger, I would say, is saying something to your child like, you know, I'm really angry at you for drawing with the markers on the wall because now we have to paint again. You need to have a consequence, right? I mean, it's okay to express anger and say you're angry and things like that, but what I'm talking about is anger that really gets you doing things, behaving poorly as a parent. Is that helpful? Did I answer it, or did I just... Okay, go ahead.
Does the tone of your voice, you can say the same words, but the tone of your voice changes possibly whether it's in control or not in control? Because the child can tell by the voice you use what your intent is, no matter what you say.
Yeah. Just to put it in perspective, Dana, the issue there with your tone of voice is, to a certain degree, children need some level of arousal when you're disciplining them, right? You don't want to be Mr. Rogers. Now, Timmy, haven't we talked before about marking on the wall with markers? You shouldn't have done that. Come here now, son, and let's talk about that, right? You need to create a certain level of arousal in your child. But research shows that most parents, when they become angry, they create a level of arousal that overstimulates the child. They become so aroused by the anger that literally the cognitive, higher functioning parts of the brain start to shut down and they are focusing. It's like, my favorite example is, have you ever watched like Charlie Brown cartoons? When the adults talk in the Charlie Brown cartoons, it's like wah, 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 and you don't ever get to hear what they're saying. And it's almost like when a kid gets overwhelmed like that, you might be telling them, how many times have I told you? You're not supposed to go in the street. And you're saying all this stuff in a very harsh, negative, loud way, and you've got the child so overwhelmed that they're not hearing what you're saying. They're just thinking, okay, get ready to duck and cover, you know, because I might, the spanking might come here soon, you know. So anyway, we had a hand back in the corner. Move on here. Let's see the right button. Okay. Marital anger. I guess we transitioned here. Yes, we did. Okay. Marital anger. I want to talk briefly about marital anger and some of the research on marital anger. After attachment, and if you're not familiar, I'm guessing most of you moms probably have read parenting books about attachment and the emotional bond the infant forms with his mother and all that. Attachment is probably the strongest predictor we have of how well kids turn out socially and emotionally, right? It's a very consistent predictor that can predict things even into adulthood, into your 20s and 30s. We've got studies that started in the 70s where we were still following these children and we can see the effects of poor attachment in their lives. Anyway, after attachment, probably the second most consistent predictor we have of how kids turn out is marital quality, right? And if you're not married, then it's still an issue. It's the co-parent relationship. Whoever the people are in charge that parent you, what is the relationship that they have together, right? Now, this is, when we talk about marital quality, a lot of times that's almost like a code word for, do you have a lot of angry, intense, unresolved conflict in your relationship? Right. So the next point here is that poor marital quality is primarily characterized by frequent and intense conflict. That is really harmful to children. So I want to talk briefly about what we have next up is what it does to children. Yes, here we go. So what does marital quality do to children? First of all, there's research looking at the indirect exposure. So this is the idea that you're having a conflict in another part of the house and the child knows it's going on and can kind of hear it through the walls or something, right? So observed or heard from another room even, silent anger even. I remember those books, my wife used to read those books, the Great Brain books. I don't know if any of you ever read those, but they're a hoot. Anyway, I won't tell you about them, but the parents in these stories, the worst punishment they give their children is the silent treatment. And they give them a sort of silent anger, and it's intense, and the kids hate it, and it's the worst thing ever. Anyway, silent anger, anger in another room, it all affects children, and specifically children who are exposed to this kind of anger, even if it's not direct, even if it's not directed at them, or it's not right in the same room with them, children tend to blame themselves for parental anger, and when they do blame themselves, the anger seems to be more harmful to them, right? Sometimes children have good cause to blame themselves for the anger because parents will say things like, you make me so angry, right? And then they end up taking responsibility for your emotions and then they start feeling a lot worse for what's happening and then they make a connection there. When mom's angry, whether it's me or dad or whatever, it's probably my fault, right? Let's go on. Direct exposure to marital anger.
What was the last one on the last page?
I think we can... anger are more harmful when children do blame themselves. Okay, so direct exposure to marital anger. Children immediately... Okay, this is when you're in the same room with them. And this is based on studies where we literally take small children and put them in a room that looks like, you know, a family room next to a kitchen with the open bar separating the kitchen from the family room, right? And we've got cameras there and we're watching what the kids are doing and what's happening. And in the background, we have two adults having a conflict. The conflict is, there's no screaming in the conflict. This is a very mild conflict is what I'm trying to suggest. There's no screaming, there's no throwing things, there's no hitting, there's no taking away things from other people. There's people saying things like, I told you to pick me up at 7. No, you didn't. You said you were supposed to pick me up at 6, and that's why I was there at 6. No, you should have been there at 7. It's not my fault you had to wait for an hour. Well, you should have said da-da-da, right? It's that kind of intense. There's tension, there's speed, there's elevated voices, but there's no like screaming, full-blown kind of conflict, right? And what we see in these children is the following. First of all, they experience emotional arousal, which we are measuring by their blood pressure, their heartbeat, all the kinds of things like that. So they do get the emotional arousal. Typically, kids aren't good at regulating their emotional states, and they're more likely to tune into the emotions that people around them are feeling. So if you're elevated and angry and upset, they're more likely to tune into that. We all do that, even adults, but children do it more than adults. Next, this idea of general distress is disorganized behavior. The child is overwhelmed by the emotional arousal they're experiencing and they don't know what to do with it. And you see this kid kind of wandering around, kind of like in what researchers call disorganized behavior. I don't know how to explain it any better than that, but they're suddenly not playing effectively, they're not necessarily interacting with peers, they're not doing anything, they're just kind of like shell-shocked walking around maybe, right? And then the last point is that some children will experience ambivalence and some children will become aggressive right there in the lab within minutes. They'll become aggressive, physically aggressive, take things away from other kids, hit other kids, things like that. And they haven't seen any of that, right? So we're assuming, well, it's not modeling. It's that something happened in them, and they got the emotional arousal, and then they start acting out on it, right? More on the direct exposure. Beyond the immediate context, beyond what happens right there in the lab, we follow these children on the playgrounds in their schools, and what we see is that the children who are exposed to this conflict have less involved play with peers. I'm still okay. All right. And they have more difficulty managing their own anger and their own emotional states compared to other kids. Actually, this is research with kids who come from high-conflict homes and some of the differences we see in them. Okay. I'm probably totally depressing you so far, right? About, well, okay. I have to give up right now. I don't want to be a parent, right? But anyway, we're going to try to get to some of the positive stuff eventually. So I want to transition, first of all, to this idea of the bright side of parental anger. First of all, conflict is normal. To a certain degree, family relationships have conflict. And you need to prepare your children for when they grow up and have families and marriages and things. They need to be able to manage conflict, manage anger. So I want to just, if any of you still, even after marriage, still hold the view that conflict is completely avoidable, then I want to say, okay, great, you must be doing something wonderful, but it's for most of the rest of us, I just want to say, you know, this is normal, and it might, you know, it's also, I want to go beyond that and say, A lot of researchers suggest that exposure to appropriate anger and appropriate conflict resolution is a good thing for children. It teaches them a lot. It has none of those negative effects we talked about. For example, the study with the kids playing and in the background are the people that are having the argument. If they resolve the conflict, the kids don't have any of those. Their emotional stuff doesn't get to the point where they're hitting each other and all that. You don't see those negative effects. So what we're really talking about is this unresolved, high-tension sort of conflict. That's the problem. So it might be a good thing for kids to see how conflict resolution works, right? So children need to see healthy examples of conflict management. And I have this, what a funny thought, right? Could you imagine saying to your kids, hey, it's time to come in and watch mom and dad have an argument. Come on in, kids, right? I think a really destructive thing that the implications of this research is that if you're the type of person who has conflicts in front of your kid and then goes up to the bedroom to resolve it and talk and work things out, and your kids only see the conflict and never see the resolution, you're probably doing some harm to your kids. You might want to consider letting them see the whole thing, or afterwards talking to them about what you did and how you resolved the conflict and letting them know what happened. We had a hand over here, or no? No, okay. Let's go on. This is the point where I might get in trouble because my wife's in the audience. But I want to talk briefly about anger and emotional honesty. Back, say, in the 70s, self-help books and experts in psychology used to say that your goal when it comes to anger and your emotions is to simply express them. Let it all hang out. Say what you need to say. The idea was if you hold it in, you'll just bottle it up and then eventually you'll pop and it'll be much worse. So just express everything, right? We know that's wrong now, okay? So we changed our minds, basically. Experts changed their minds. By the time you get to the 80s, 90s, people are saying anger is a secondary emotion. And when you're angry, your goal is to try and think about what is it that's really going on with you and then express that, right? And that's probably better than the first one, but I still think we can go a little bit farther, okay? Nowadays, some of the latest relationship and self-help books that are coming out now, based on, you know, the ones that are research-based at least, this is what they're suggesting. Your goal in a relationship is to express your positive feelings as freely as possible and to express negative feelings with care, right? As carefully as you can. You don't just let it all hang out and say whatever and say it as soon as you feel it, because that's the fast path to unmanageable conflict and relationship destruction, right? Now, I think this is good. I think this is a good position. And as a researcher, I think the research justifies this position here. Now, this is the only time in all these presentations, I think, that I'm going to actually talk about gospel-y kind of things. I want to take things just a little bit farther, because I think when talking about anger, we just have to deal with some sort of ethical issues here. So it's at this point that I get in trouble by telling the brownie story. There are two kinds of people in this world, right? The people who eat their brownies immediately and the people who like to save some of their brownies for later. Right, and you know this. How many of you are the kind of people who wolf down the brownies immediately? Right, look at you. You should be ashamed of yourselves. Right, how many of you are the kind of people who like to, you know, portion your brownies? You have maybe like one now, and you save some. You put them in the fridge. Right, where are you? Raise your hands. Be proud. You're good people. Right, I'm one of those people. I like to save my brownies. Unfortunately, I married a woman who likes to eat all the brownies she can as soon as they come out of the oven. Not only that, but somehow she passed that gene on to my children. Okay? So, one more piece of background I need to tell you before I go into this story, which is my wife doesn't like a lot of sugary treats in our house. We don't do a lot of sugar. We don't do a lot of treats. It's not like we bake brownies all the time. So some of you who like bake brownies whenever you feel like it, you need to understand that brownies in our house might be like a once-a-year deal. This is the big time. This is serious stuff. When we make brownies, there's a lot at stake here. Okay, so we make brownies. I'm married. I got these three little kids. And you know how kids are about, you know, you got to cut the thing perfectly. They're all sitting there wanting to measure it. We almost got to get one of those surveyor guys to come out and map out the pan and make sure the pieces are all exactly the same. You know, and we divide them all up. We pull them out of the pan and then shoom, 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 shoom. You know. All the brownies are gone, and the only thing that's left is like my three brownies, right? There's my three brownies. And I'm okay with that, you know. I don't need to eat them all. So I eat maybe like half a brownie. And I think, that's good enough for now. I'll save my rest of my brownies for later. So I wrap my brownies up, and I put them in the fridge. And I'm the type of person that, you know, I'm so busy with work and school. I mean, I was in graduate school, and I was working full-time, and I was crazy busy. And maybe like 4 days later, I remember, as I'm sitting down eating dinner, that I have brownies in the fridge. And I'm excited, and I think, I'm going to go have another half of a brownie. So I go to the fridge, and I open the door, and I look where I placed the brownies, and the brownies are not there. The brownies are not there. And I'm starting to get unhappy about this, right? I'm thinking, somebody ate my brownies. I'm going through the fridge looking. I want to double check and make sure before I go accuse somebody, right? But I'm thinking, somebody ate my brownies, and this is not right. Somebody's going to have to pay for this, right? And I search, looking, you know, rummaging through the fridge, and I'm like, did somebody eat my brownies? Where are my brownies? I can't find my brownies. And after a thorough search of the fridge, I'm sure that there are no brownies in there anywhere. And I start thinking, okay, who did it? Who ate my brownies? Right? And my children are young at this point, and they still fear me. So I'm thinking, they wouldn't have done it. There's no way that any of the kids would have dared to eat my brownies. I know who ate my brownies. There's only one other person in this household who would have done it, right? It's that woman I married who has a sweet tooth, so she tells us we can't have sweets in the house. And she ate my brownies. And I'm thinking, this is just not fair. This is not right. I deserve to have my brownies, don't I? I mean, we divided them up. It was all fair and square. And I had 3 brownies, and now I don't get to have them. I only had 1/2 a brownie. That means she ate, like, you know, I'm doing the math. I'm going, she had, like, 5.5 brownies, and I had 1/2. That's not fair. That drives me crazy. I can't believe she ate my brownies. And she doesn't respect me, right? I mean, how could she do this? If she really cared about me and respected me, how could she just take my... That's stealing. It's stealing, right? It's wrong. She's setting a bad example for our children. They're going to learn to steal because she ate my brownies. Oh, man, I'm so mad. I can't believe she did that. Now that I think about it, you know she does this all the time. We go to a restaurant, and afterwards they say, do you want some dessert? And I say, okay, yeah, sure, I want this dessert here. Mara says, no, I'm fine, I don't need dessert, right? And then the dessert comes, and I'm eating it, and my wife suddenly is just saying, oh, I want a taste of that, right? She's like, she's wanting to have the taste of it. And I'm there saying, no, I ordered this. If you want some, you order your own. This is mine, right? And she just keeps taking more bites. Oh, that's good, let me try that part. Oh, this is, you know. And I'm just so mad as heck, and I'm sitting there in front of the fridge going, I have had enough of this. I'm going to talk to her. This is not right. I can't believe she ate my brownies. And I start marching off looking for my wife to unload on her about how mad I am that she ate my brownies. And happily, my wife, I think, prays a lot and is a very righteous woman. And so because of that, this spirit sort of inserts this thought into the back of my head. And just for a moment, I had this thought that says, you know, you're being pretty petty about this. Brownies. <Yeah. laughs> And I almost, you know, I think, again, I tried to push that thought out of my head, but again, I think my wife's a righteous woman, and the thought came back again, a little stronger. You know she has a sweet tooth. She likes treats more than you. She had 3 children. Went through childbirth. You saw that. That's tough. She has lived in poverty with you the whole time you've been married because you decided you wanted to get a PhD after you married her. And she's never once complained. She's never asked you for jewelry or vacations or anything. She stays home and takes care of the kids and she does her best to take care of you. And you know, and all these thoughts came into my head, and as I thought about those things, I realized that it was pretty petty to be upset with this woman because she ate my brownies, right? And I realized, as I thought about that, that a lot of the anger just started to go away, and it occurred to me that I was bigger than this, you know, that I could actually maybe not get mad at my wife about brownies. Because I love her, and I care about her, And, you know, the prophet says, don't get mad at your wife. There's all kinds of good reasons to not be mad at her. In effect, what ended up happening was the anger went away. My heart changed. And I wasn't mad anymore. Now, unfortunately for my wife, that's not the norm. That doesn't always happen. But in that moment, it happened and taught me something really important, which is when it comes to expressing anger, sometimes my goal should probably be not even to try and figure out, well, what are you really mad about, right? But my goal should be to change my heart, right? To think about my anger and put it in the context of my relationship with my wife and my values, right? So I just want to lay that out as maybe like the final option there for emotional honesty, which is that sometimes, you know, anger and other negative feelings are petty, and we should probably try to change our hearts and not express them at all. So our goal might be to put our feelings in line with our values and our love for our family and our spouse. Right? Go ahead.
So where were the Browns?
Pardon me?
So where were the Browns?
I never went there. I never talked to her about it. And you know, the funny thing is, I noticed that for about 3 or 4 days she was really nice to me when I didn't do that. She's really nice to me. It's like, it's almost like she, oh, he didn't get mad or something. She was nice to me for a while. And I thought, oh, this isn't such a bad thing. You know, it's just like, okay, go ahead. Well, see, I don't enjoy that as much. I'd rather try and say them. That's who I am, and, you know, I need to stand up for my convictions.
You find a better hiding spot.
Yes, yes. Now that I've tried, that works. Okay, go ahead.
What about things that aren't petty? There's a lot of difficult family issues that some people have to deal with, and their brownies are simple. But what about mixed families or... I know that's a hard thing to answer, but that's a good source of anger.
First of all, let me look at how much time I have left. What I need to do is get farther into the presentation, because I want to talk, obviously, about how to deal with real anger and conflict resolution and all that. But I certainly am not trying to suggest that you... All I'm trying to say is that you try to filter what you're feeling and make sure that it's not something petty or something that shouldn't be expressed. For example, one of the things that's worked for me sometimes when I've been able to do it is I try to, if something's really, really bugging me and I know I'm going to totally have a meltdown over it, I tell myself, okay, well, wait a day and see what's happening. See how you feel. You'll usually have a better perspective on your anger. Sometimes you don't have the anger anymore. Maybe that's a guy thing, I don't know. But for me, it's sometimes just waiting or things like that. So I try to filter, or you should try to filter. I better not say make statements like that because my wife might need to get up here and have a rebuttal or something. Let's go on. Now I want to talk about conflict and conflict resolution. Conflict versus negativity is the first thing I want to talk about. Now I want to suggest to you that there's a whole lot of research on conflict resolution in family studies, in psychology, in business, in communication studies. And I want to suggest to you that it's a dead end. It's not really the solution that we're looking for. And I'm going to talk to you mostly today about a guy named John Gottman. I brought a couple of his books and you can look at them afterwards. One of them is called 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work. He has a bunch of books, though. Just go Google John Gottman, Gottman, and you'll find a whole bunch of books about marriage and stuff. Here's one that he wrote about parenting, though, called Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child. So some of the things I'm going to suggest are in these two books. And then if you have, like, and you don't have to, like, raise your hand or anything, but if you have, like, personal problems with anger, like, if you're really struggling with your own anger, this is another book I would recommend called Scream-Free Parenting by a fellow named Hal Edward Runkel, R-U-N-K-E-L. And it's a good book. Anyway, let's go on and talk about most of what I'm going to say from here on out is stuff that comes from Gottman and his research. Oh, yes, there's another one. I wasn't going to even say that in my presentation. Someone is sending me a note saying, read The Peace Giver. Yes. So I would say that's an excellent book. It's an LDS book about relationships and the role that the atonement can play in helping us overcome negative feelings. So it's a wonderful book. The Peace Giver. Who's the author on that? Does anybody know? I know it's a... No, it's not Warner. It's one of his students, but I don't remember the guy's name.
Is it
Wilcox?
No.
No, it's not Wilcox. I don't remember. Anyways.
Go to Deseret.
Go to Deseret Book and look up The Peace Giver. It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful LDS perspective on anger and families and things like that. Oh, you want your notes back. Okay. Well, let's go on. What I want to suggest to you is that negativity is actually the real thing you need to deal with in your families rather than how to resolve a conflict once it happens. Okay, so I'm going to talk. I'm going to use some of Gottman's research to talk about negativity. I think it's the real issue going on. For example, here's one example of some of the stuff that Gottman has found. He has found that the ratio of positive to negative communication is actually a very strong predictor of divorce. In fact, it's one of the strongest predictors we know of. In Gottman's research and some of his studies, he's got longitudinal studies where he can predict divorce with about a 93% accuracy using models that look at different types of positive communication and negative communication and the ratio between them. You don't see anything like that in the social sciences. That's just phenomenal. I mean, I'm used to studies where people can predict something with like a 75% accuracy or a 60% accuracy, and they're all excited, right? Let's go on. Strong marriages operate a lot like a strong friendship. There's, in terms of some of the positive things that need to happen in a marriage. And okay, before we go on, I just need to say, a lot of this that we're going to talk about applies to parenting. And I'm going to try to remember as we go through it to talk about how it applies to parenting as well. And notice how I have the word female in parentheses there, because really what Gottman is describing is female friendships and how they operate. Strong marriages look a lot like that. So let me give you an example of some of that. First of all, knowledge about your partner's world. Talking a lot about... Gottman, for example, in one of his books here, has exercises for married couples. Things like, ask the following 100 questions of your spouse and have them ask you those same 100 questions. And the questions are things like, who's your best friend right now? What are the greatest challenges you're facing in your life? What are your biggest fears? Who was your best friend in fifth grade? Who's your favorite teacher of all time? What's your favorite food? Just everything that has to do with getting to know your spouse better. Some of it is just preferences and history. Some of it is about their emotional world and what's going on with them. Pardon?
Love maps.
Love maps. Yeah, he calls them love maps, right? Pardon? Oh, it's just in this book he refers to them as love maps because that sounds a little more sexy, doesn't it? I mean, you could talk your husband into that, right? You could say, hey, honey, come on, we're going to work on our love maps. And he'd be like, yeah, let's go, right? But I'm just trying to put it in, pardon me? The book is called, this book here is called The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work. Okay. But he's got newer ones. I only get old books because I'm poor and I can find them for like $2, right? Gottman wrote these two, and then this one's by Runkel, R-U-N-K-E-L, The Scream-Free Parenting. Right. Okay, let's go on. Gottman talks about expressing fondness and admiration, doing this as much as possible. Now, sometimes when I talk about this in my classes, my students will say, well, wait a minute, you're not going to just try to like pretend you're all, you know, fake anything, right? And Gottman's not suggesting that you fake anything or pretend like you appreciate your spouse. He's suggesting that you, anytime you feel, you know, ponder it, think about it. What are the things you admire about your spouse? And then when you feel them, tell your spouse, right? And he says that should be happening a whole lot. The more that happens, the better, right? I remember the first time I read this, I went home and experimented on my wife, right? I went home and I started just telling her all these things that I felt about her. Now, I wasn't making it up. I just sat down and I thought for a lot on the way home. I was thinking, okay, what are all the things I want to say to her? Because men don't do that a lot. Men don't talk too much about what they appreciate and, you know, they don't express fondness. So I got home and I started just sort of saying these things to my wife here and there, right? And it only took her about an hour to kind of like, okay, what's up? You know, what do you want, right? Pardon me? Right, yeah, no, it wasn't like that. But the truth is, even though she was aware that something was up, it did change her mood. And it made her much more happier, just like it would anybody, right? So I'd encourage any of you to go home and try this as an experiment. Just go and try to, on a daily basis as much as possible, just remind your spouse about all the things you love about them. And express to your spouse all the things you admire about them, right? It's a good thing, right? Let's go on. Mindfulness. Here's another issue that Gottman talks about. In his book, he talks about the term, he refers to it as turning towards instead of turning away. And he explains that in any given day in your marriage or in your home with your kids, there's all these little tiny opportunities, micro little moments of your day where you could connect or miss each other, right? We're driving in the car and my wife says, oh, look at that tree, it's pretty. Gottman refers to that as, that's a bid for connection. I can kind of ignore her and not notice she just said that and kind of go, bleh, right? Or maybe I could say, yeah, I really like that tree. What kind of a tree is that, honey? Right? And I just turn towards. We've just connected. And it's all these little tiny micro connections, he says, that strengthen a marriage, that strengthen a friendship. Right? There's something about that idea. And an easier term for me is just the idea of being mindful of that person and trying to pay attention to what they're saying and pay attention to those bids for connection. Right? And couples who do this, again, they're much less likely to get divorced and they're much more likely to have a strong marriage. Here's another issue. Accepting influence. Now, Gottman's research suggests that this is more of a problem for men, right? It's the idea that women are typically better at, as a group, they're better at accepting influence from their spouse. Men sometimes have trouble with that. And he says men need to be able to listen to their spouse. It doesn't mean you have to do whatever your wife says all the time, but it means you listen to what she says, you validate what she says, you take it into consideration, you make your decisions together. You treat her like what she says really matters, right? Hopefully we don't, the LDS men in this audience don't have a problem with this, but yes, it becomes really important. Some of these things you can see have application to parenting, right? To a certain degree as a parent, you need to accept influence from your children. You need to listen to them, validate what their point of view, take seriously what they're saying. Don't just blow it off or don't just tell them to be quiet because I'm the parent. So some of these issues cut across into other types of relationships. Same thing with expressing fondness and admiration, knowing about your child. In fact, in this book here about raising an emotionally intelligent child, if you go through some of the steps he talks about, they're similar to these kinds of issues, knowing about your child's emotional world. He gives you strategies for being able to do that. Let's go on. The point here is that when the marital friendship is strong, conflict resolution is easier. And I probably should have made that in bold with, bright blinking on and off or something like that. But the idea here, the reason I started off by talking about marital friendship instead of conflict resolution is because this is the stuff that actually predicts how well you're going to do when it's time to have a conflict. Okay? So this is like the foundation for your ability to work out differences with your spouse. And I'll try to make those linkages really clear in a minute. So let's go on now. Destructive patterns. Gottman's research has identified destructive patterns of marital conflict. First of all, there's this thing called the harsh startup, right? Wives are the ones who typically do this. Now, I'm not picking on women here. It's a fact that women generally are the people who bring up relationship issues. Men don't do it, right? Men, in Gottman's research, about 70 to 80% of the time, it's the woman who's bringing up issues. So this idea of a harsh way of bringing up issues is more of a problem for women, not because they're worse than men, but because they're more likely to be the ones bringing up the problem. The harsh startup is the idea that you say something like, I am sick and tired of you always going off with the other guys to play basketball at the church. You never spend time with me. It's like you don't even like me. We need to have a talk about this right now because I'm not putting up with it anymore. Right? That's a harsh startup. Right? A soft startup might be, I really love you and I like spending time with you and I want more of you in my life. Is there any way that, can we talk about this and figure out a way that you and I can spend more time together? And those are two very different ways of starting a conflict or a conversation that could lead to a conflict, right? So the idea is the harsh startup is something that's going to put the spouse on the defensive from the beginning, right? So you're going into the conflict resolution already putting the person on the defensive. And it ends up being a very destructive pattern because this is what happens. In Gottman's research, he sees that if a wife starts off with a harsh startup, the husband becomes defensive and escalates the conflict higher than where she started it. And then she matches him in intensity, and he escalates again, and she matches him in intensity, and they just go like this, and next thing you know, you have a very loud, angry, out-of-control conflict. So he sees that as a strong pattern. In fact, in some of his studies, he only needs to use the first 30 to 60 seconds of videotape of your conflict to make a prediction as to whether or not you're going to get a divorce. I mean, it's that pronounced that conflicts that start harsh like that don't go anywhere. So where you start determines where you end, right? Let's go on. Flooding. Oops. Oh, yeah, there you go. I just put it there. Wives start it, husbands escalate and become defensive. Flooding is a term that Gottman uses for something that psychologists call diffuse psychological arousal. Basically, flooding is when you become overwhelmed by the conflict. You become overwhelmed. Men will hit that fight or flight response, right? Their bodies. Oh, go ahead. Oh, 5 minutes? Oh, my goodness. How did that happen to you? Okay. I don't know what to do at this point. Let's just go on. Okay. So men do this more than women. They have an intense reaction to verbal conflict. They don't manage it as well. Gottman says in one of his books, he says, in a world of verbal conflict, women swim and men sink. They don't do well. They get overwhelmed. They get stressed out. So men do this thing called stonewalling. Right? That's when they shut down on you. You've seen men do that, right? You're having a conversation, it gets really intense, and suddenly he does this whole, yeah, okay, whatever, you know. He stops looking at you, stops connecting, and you can tell he just closed down, right? Sometimes he gets up and walks in the other room and says, I'm done, or he goes for a drive or something. He's overwhelmed by the conflict. That's stonewalling. And the destructive pattern is that he'll stonewall and the female will pursue, right? What happens if I'm having a conflict with my wife and I find, okay, that's it, I'm done. I don't need to talk about this anymore. And I kind of cross my leg and I cross my arms, or maybe I grab the paper and start reading, right? The destructive thing is if my wife decides to come over here and get in front of me. If my wife pursues, if she comes and engages and tries to get me back into the conversation, and then I try to withdraw and she tries to pursue and I try to withdraw and she tries to pursue, that's a destructive pattern that's predictive of divorce, right? Let's go on. Here's a graph. And I need to explain this quickly because I probably only have 2 minutes by now. What you see there, I don't know if you can see that or not, but the red line is males and the yellow line is females. And the first, I'm going to have to walk over here, I guess, so you won't hear. I'll talk really loud. Okay, this is the male's heart rate, resting heart rate. This is the female's resting heart rate. Typically, a female has about a 64 beats per minute. Men have about 72 beats per minute, but this is a little high for his study. Anyway, so there they are resting. This is when the conflict starts. His heartbeat is out of control right away. Look at her. She's not having an intense reaction from the verbal conflict, right? He's much more stressed out by it. Here they are in their conflict. His heart is beating at 95 beats per minute. That means he is in a state of diffuse psychological arousal. He is in fight or flight mode, and his body is telling him, beat this woman up or run for your life, right? So, what does he do? He does this withdrawal thing, right? This is him when he starts the withdrawal thing. I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I'm done. He stops making eye contact. He looks away. He does something to get a handle on his psychological arousal. He does actually calm down. He's now at about 85 beats per minute. He's handling it a lot better. But what happens to her when he pulls away? What happens to you when you're mad, when you're talking in that important conversation and he pulls away? Yeah, you get mad. You get upset. It stresses you out more than the conflict, right? It bothers you more that he withdrew than the conflict does, right? So there you are now in this other mode having conflict with him withdrawn, and now you're still not getting anywhere. This is the conflict ends, and look at your recovery time versus his recovery time. Right? So what you're seeing is men are stressed out more by verbal conflict. When they withdraw, they have a better time of it, but the woman stresses out more. And then when it's over, they come down from it a lot more slowly than the women do. I need to move on. I want to see what I can get through. Sex differences. Okay, so here we go. Women are socialized to resolve conflicts verbally. Most women in this room probably spent a lot of time as children with other girls having verbal conflicts. Boys didn't do that. They didn't get the practice. They're not good at it. So some of this might be socialization, right? Oh, I got sound effects. Women define intimacy in terms of verbal communication, typically. Intimacy is a talking process, right? Men, conflict is seen often as a step towards intimacy. We need to resolve this so we can be close again, right? Whereas men, sorry about that. Men define intimacy in terms of shared activities. A lot of times, there doesn't need to be a lot of conversation. It's that we're doing something together. That's what keeps us close. Or another thing that men do in intimacy in friendships, male friendships, is they avoid conflict. Because conflict is more likely in male relationships to signal the end of a relationship if there's a serious conflict. So boys, growing up, learn not to have conflicts with friends. So a man is actually trying to have a friendship with you. It's just that he's doing it in boy way. And boy way means I'm not going to engage with you when I'm really upset because I might punch you and then our friendship's over, right? So men go into conflict management mode to protect intimacy, and then the woman perceives that as a break in intimacy and gets really upset. And that's one of the problems that's happening there. Let's see. I'm supposed to end in 1 minute. Okay, I can keep going. Why not? No, I should skip to the solutions. That's what I should do. I think I just messed up. No, I just messed up. Oh, this is so bad. I can run over? Oh, don't say that to me. That's dangerous. Okay.
Just keep talking.
Okay. Oh, thank you. He's going to reset it. any questions up to this point? No. Okay. Pardon me? Something
about men do conflict management is the last point.
Men define intimacy in terms of shared activities, right? That's why for your husband, sitting down and watching TV together is like a date, right? Also, though, men define intimacy in terms of conflict avoidance. So the people that I can avoid conflicts with, those are the people, that's how you get close to people, by avoiding conflict for a prolonged period. Just imagine this. I had a best friend in grade school, Danny Fitzpatrick. I met him when I was 9, and he was my best friend until I was 14, and we never once had a fight. How many females in the room can say the same thing, that you had a best friend for a 5-year period and you never once had a fight with them? Okay, I got 2? Okay, good. Okay, that proved my point. Right. How many of you had a best friend with whom you maybe had fights and breakups and get back togethers and fights and breakups and get back togethers? Okay. We yay, all right. Okay, let's keep going. All right. There we go. Yay. More destructive patterns of marital conflict. These are other things that Gottman's identified. First of all, he says criticism is really bad. Again, you're talking about positives versus negatives, right? These are types of negative things that happen. Criticism, not complaints. Complaints are okay. It's okay to complain in a marriage. It's not okay to criticize, right? Complaining, for example, you said you were going to do the dishes tonight. You didn't do them. What happened, right? That's a complaint. Versus a criticism is, you know, every time you do this, you say you're going to do the dishes and then you never do them and you're just such a lazy bum, right? That's criticism, right? There's a difference there. Contempt, not anger. Okay, anger, again, Gottman says, now I'm not saying anger is okay from an LDS point of view, right? From a gospel point of view, I'm going to say repent of your anger, right? But what I'm trying to say from a research point of view is that anger is not what destroys relationships. It's contempt. It's the negative, bitter nastiness that you express when you get angry. And if you can stop doing that, you're really going to do a lot better in all your relationships, right? So anger is not as big a problem. In other words, Gottman says it doesn't lead to divorce. Okay. Inability to accept influence. Again, we've already talked about that, right? Men who can't accept influence, that's a real problem. Failed repair attempts. Okay, now I need to talk to you about repair attempts, which is, I think, one of the more important things that Gottman has discovered. Repair attempts are things that people do when communication breaks down. When you've just said something wrong, or your spouse has just said something wrong, and things are going bad in the conversation, and you say something or do something to try and fix it, right? So, for example, I might say to my wife, uh-oh, I really didn't mean to say that like that. I didn't want it to come out like that. Can I try again? Right? Or maybe just saying, I'm sorry. Or maybe introducing some humor, right? Cracking a joke, and suddenly my wife is smiling, and I know she's not mad, and then I try to, it's a way of letting her know that I didn't mean to say that, right? There's different ways that Gottman sees that people do these repair attempts. When they don't work, that's really bad, okay? When repair attempts fail, it's really harmful. And I need to explain, so I'm going to go into some detail here on repair attempts. Strong couples aren't better at communicating. That's one of the things that Gottman was surprised to discover, because he was a psychologist who mostly studied communication. And he learned that strong couples who stay married and have strong, healthy, happy marriages, they're not better at communicating. They're better at fixing broken communication. Okay, this is why it's important. Gottman, by some estimates, not just him, but other researchers say that most communication, more than half of our communication in relationships, is miscommunication. We miscommunicate a lot. Okay, so I'm going to go on here. So the idea there is, whether you miscommunicate 40% of the time or 70% of the time, it doesn't matter. It's enough miscommunication to destroy a relationship. The important thing is, can you fix communication when it breaks down? So the repair attempt is actually one of the things he discovered he calls it the happy couple's secret weapon. It's the thing that helps them to maintain their happy relationship, being able to repair when things break down, right? So what determines, here's the important point, this is going to take us back to marital friendship, what determines if you receive your spouse's repair attempt or not? They just said something and it bugs you, and now they make the repair attempt, and the issue is, do you go, yeah, I know he didn't mean that, or she didn't mean that, I'll give him a break? Or do you go, no, you're always saying stuff like that, I'm tired of it, I don't want to, and you go on with more confidence, or I don't believe you, you're just saying that. You're not really sorry. What determines that response? Gottman says, ultimately, it's the marital friendship. All right? It's kind of like that bank metaphor. Have you put in enough deposits when it's time to make a withdrawal? Right? Yes, I am. I'm positive. I talk to my wife about how fond I am of her and how much I appreciate her. And I try to be mindful of her when she's talking to me. And I try to know a lot about her world. I try to do all these things. And if I do these things and I have a lot of connection and friendship, strong friendship with my wife, then when I put my foot in my mouth, she's more likely to accept my repair attempt. Right? So the repair attempt, the issue is, it's not about how effective you are at making the repair attempt. It's not how much skill you have at repair attempts. It's what predicts ultimately is, do you have a strong marital friendship? Do you have a lot of that positive stuff going on? Right? Okay. So, the harsh startup revisited. So now we're going to go back and do the same thing with the harsh startup. I want to show you how ultimately it's grounded in friendship. The harsh startup is perhaps the second strongest predictor of divorce after the repair attempts kind of thing, right? What determines whether a wife uses a harsh startup or not? It's the degree to which the husband accepts influence. Okay, so Gottman has found that when husbands are not accepting of influence from their wives are more likely to get negative and eventually start off with this harsh startup, right? So again, the harsh startup even goes back to a friendship kind of issue. If you're involved with your wife and fondness and appreciation and accepting her influence and all that stuff, then she's less likely when she does bring up the issues, because she's the one who brings them up. She'll bring them up in a more positive way, right? So again, the marital friendship is what determines the outcomes. Okay, solutions, finally. Okay, now we get to talk about solutions. These are pretty obvious from what we've talked about, right? First of all, know each other. Spend time getting to know each other. Have dates and activities that involve getting to know each other more. Pretend that next week there's going to be a ward activity where you're all going to play the newlywed game, and you're going to have to know all kinds of things about your wife, right? And just try to learn everything you can about her. And same thing for your wife, everything you can about your husband, right? Express fondness and appreciation as much as you can, as often as you can. Ponder what you... Remind yourself about why you love your spouse and all the qualities that they have that you admire, right? And then express those. Be mindful of each other. Yeah, we've already talked about some of these. Protect the marital or family friendship from bad conflict. Okay, so again, there's some of these negative conflict patterns, and they apply to parenting too. my son Nathaniel, I remember he shot up when he was about 13. He got really tall, so he's about as tall as my wife. And suddenly, when they were having conflicts, I started to get concerned, because I thought, he's a big kid now, and he might, you know. And my wife one day, this isn't like typical of us, I'm just saying, this is just a story, and I hope I don't get in trouble for it. But once, my wife and Nathaniel were having a conflict, and I could tell that he was getting flooded, that he was getting aroused. He's like that, he gets flooded pretty easily. He's I don't know, maybe he's a typical guy, but he stormed upstairs, and he slammed the door, right? And my wife started to just march upstairs right behind him, right? To go knock on the door and say, you come out here, young man, we need to address this now. You can't just walk away from me like that, right? And I was concerned there, and I think there's an implication there that, you know, sometimes with your boys, you need to think about this. You need to, if you see the signs that they're getting sort of flooded, what Gottman says, I think I had it on the PowerPoint, 95 beats a minute, right? You take your pulse when you're having a conflict with your spouse. And if you get over 95, oh, time out, 95 beats. It's a good rule for husbands. They like it, right? Husbands like it a lot. Oh, sorry, honey. Time out. 95 beats. I'm out of here. Right? But you can do that, certainly. Maybe it sounds stupid to do that. Maybe you're not going to seriously do this. But Gottman actually recommends this for people in his marriage seminars. But you could certainly try to do this with your children as well. If you see that they're getting so stressed out, give them a chance to cool down, back off, right? Especially your boys. Here's a hand. Go ahead. How does the rest of the family help him?
Or we'll just help each other. I mean, I don't know what to do with him. We're still working on that.
Wow, yeah, that's kind of like, that's beyond what I was prepared to talk about today. But honestly, it seems like there's, Gottman talks about self-soothing strategies that you can use in a family, different ways to help your children to sort of talk about. We are going to kind of get to that with children, like how to help them label what they're feeling and discuss it. He talks about even doing things like massage and things like that to kind of help soothe and calm people. So there's different strategies that he recommends that you might be able to use with everybody else, but although it wouldn't work with your son. Does that?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Okay, let's go on. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Part of that is, okay, think about this. In a marriage, let's say you have a date every Friday night, right? Don't decide to bring up some issue Friday when your husband gets home at 5:30, right? You do things to make sure that the positives and the intimacy and all those things are going to happen, right? And you kind of protect the good stuff and the intimacy from the conflict, if you can. Does that help? Okay. All right. Let's go on. When you can't over... Now, here's another point. Again, this one should have been bold with bright lights blinking and all that. But this is one of my... Pardon me?
7-1.
Yeah. I honestly think this is one of the most important rules that anybody needs to have for parenting or marriage is instead of trying to make the negatives go away or confront all the negative stuff happening, try to increase the positives in the relationship. Research would seem to suggest that as you increase the positives in the relationship, the negatives are going to go away by themselves. So rather than tackling the negatives and trying to decrease them, the simple solution is to increase the positives. That's part of what Gottman's saying by saying, focus on the friendship. Don't focus on the conflict. Yeah, he's got these little skills he can teach you about conflict, but they don't stop you from getting a divorce. What stops you from getting a divorce is strengthening your marital friendship, right? Hopefully that puts things in perspective for you. Let's go on. Some of the skills he teaches, the soft startup, right? Gottman actually has, here's 100 ways to do a soft startup, right? Read, you know, you could actually just read something if your mind's bottled as to how to do this, right? But bring up issues in a very careful way, right? Start the conflicts in a very careful way. Repair attempts. Like, although skill doesn't matter, one of the things that Gottman suggests is that you learn to make the repair attempts explicit. Okay, as for example, you might agree, from now on, if I say this word, that means I'm trying to make a repair attempt, right? Or you might actually say something like, okay, honey, I'm sorry, I'm going to make a repair attempt now. Here it goes, right? But the idea is you make them explicit because sometimes people just miss them. One of Gottman's research findings is that positive people who have a positive outlook on their marriage, are more accurate at seeing repair attempts. And people who are very negative about their marriage don't even see them. They'll totally miss them sometimes. Right? Okay. Now they're really kicking me out. Okay. All right. Let's see. Oops. Okay. Avoid flooding. Again, we talked about that, the 95 beats per minute. Letting your husband or your boys take a break. Complaining without criticism or contempt. We've already talked a little bit about that. And then here's this last point, which is, I guess I'm going to just defer, rather than trying to explain all this, I'm going to defer to this book. It's called Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child. And in it, Gottman talks about this thing called emotion coaching with children, which basically looks like this. These are the points of emotion coaching. And I need to go because I don't know what she's saying, but I can tell it's serious. So we better end it. Oh, pardon me? The CD's ending. Okay. All right. Well, people in CD land, goodbye. We can turn this off, and if you want, I'll take questions since there's no reason to end, but go ahead and turn it off, I guess. Whatever. All right. Does anyone? You guys can go or ask questions or whatever.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.